This season of Good Morning is brought to you by Picaluna Beautiful Funerals, who are changing funerals for the better by tailoring them to you.
Whether you are caring for someone at the end of their life or planning for the future, Picaluna is all about helping you say goodbye in the best possible way. Start having the conversation today.
To Good Morning, the podcast talking all things grief with honesty and humour. Welcome back to the Good Morning podcast.
We are your hosts, Sal and Im, and we are back today with an incredibly inspiring guest for you all. But before we get stuck into that, Sal, what's been happening in your world? How are you?
I'm good. I've got to say, just for anyone listening, if you can hear some weird noises, Albert is underneath my desk and he is snoring really loudly. So if you can hear.
Oh, I just heard it.
Yeah, he's so loud. Like, honestly, sometimes he makes my office like shake. So that's the weird noise. I'm all right. Not long ago finished watching One Day. Have you watched it on Netflix, Im? Because I tell you what, I had the biggest one-day triggered grief sesh. One of the biggest grief sessions that I've had in a long time. Have you seen it?
Yeah, you're not alone there. I was an absolute mess. And I was not expecting that. Like, can this show come with a trigger warning? I did not expect that.
I feel like it should.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for listeners who haven't watched it, One Day is a Netflix show. And the last episode is very, very griefy. Not to give away any spoilers, but honestly, it just like, I was off. Like, I was off to the races. The box came out, I was in the office. Like,
oh my God, you got the box out too.
Oh, the box came out, a proper subathon. And it just, yeah, lasted ages. I mean, sometimes you do, I think you need that sort of, you know, when you can feel the emotions there and you need to watch something that's a bit griefy or sad to kind of kick things off. So that was the kickstart for a very long but very good grief sesh. But yeah, that's can't stop thinking about it because it was just like so sad.
And old mate's not bad on the eyes too, is he?
He, you know, I mean, look, he's not too shabby, is he? Let's not lie. what about you, Im? How are you doing?
Oh, look, I don't even know. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. You guys know we show up real and raw here on Good Morning, and I'm having a day or a week or a month. I don't know. It's just been a bit on, and I'm exhausted. I actually had a grief sesh last night, but like you were saying, sometimes you need that trigger to help it. And I think that might be when you're further along. I think in the early months, it was really easy and I couldn't turn the tap off. Like it was just, you know, constantly, I was just overly emotional all the time.
Yeah. Early months, there was like triggers would be things that reminded us of our mums or thinking about them. And it was constant, yeah. Right? Whereas, yeah, now it's like sometimes they're spontaneous, but also you kind of, yeah, you sometimes need to draw it out, right? And it's I feel like way back then we would have never thought that we would be here now saying that, you know.
Oh God, no. But it now, and I think you're the same, but it's, I think probably because of the work that we do, we're quite in tune with ourselves emotionally. But it is that feeling, that kind of irritable, anxious feeling that sits in your heavy in your chest. And it's almost like wanting to come up out through your throat, but you know you need to cry, but it's just sitting there. And I kind of just went through the whole day yesterday with it sitting there. And then I was like, oh, fuck this. I need to get it out. I know it's there and it needs to come out. So, and I just went into the shower and had a, yeah, grief session in the shower. You know, I sent you a picture, obviously, but my face was so puffy and my eyes were red and
a steamy grief sesh, mate. Thank you for sending me a picture, because if you didn't send me a picture, it didn't happen.
That was one of my best, that one too. Like, I will not let anyone see me like that.
That it was a cracker. Level. Look, the amount of, like, pictures that we've got of each other having grief sessions, you know, let's hope that we're always friends, because, you know, you could put some pretty ugly pictures of me out there.
We should get a photo book made with them.
Yes, grief, maybe a little, photo book. Grief sessions through the years. But I'm sorry to hear that you're having a day slash week slash, you know, a time of it.
Life.
It's also... It just have, yeah, sorry to hear you having a life in. It's your like anniversary sort of slog, isn't it, at the moment? You're kind of like coming to the end of it, right?
Yeah, I'm right in the middle of it. I've got mum's birthday coming up. I've got all the things. So yeah, probably anticipating that, right? Because it's always the lead up to that is griefy.
Yeah,
why am I questioning it like we don't know?
You feel it though before. It's always that thing, isn't it? Like, oh, why am I feeling tired? Why am I feeling anxious, emotional? Because I've got an anniversary this week. That's why. And then Mother's Day, just to put the icing on the cake, you know?
Yeah, cheers for that. But yeah, I'm okay. Oh, I'm just stripping it back and I'm acknowledging that this is how I feel right now and I'm not going to feel this way forever. And no, I'm not like... you know, having a stroke or a heart attack, I'm just anxious and all the things I have to talk myself out of the spirals that I have when I'm feeling like this, when there's a lot on my plate. So I apologize to you, Sal, if I haven't been showing up as best as I normally would lately, but yeah, I've just been a bit preoccupied.
You've been doing amazingly, you've been absolutely brilliant. And yeah, I'm impressed by how present and amazing you've been considering everything you've been going through. So please don't apologize. Also, can we quickly tell listeners about your first ever ice bath?
Oh, I'd love to. So this is just the sweetest thing ever. Sal knew I was going through a lot of stuff and I was exhausted and she wanted to do something nice for me. So she took me to this place that's not far from my house and it's called Reset. So you do this circuit where you go into the sauna or the steam room and then you go into the ice bath and then you go back into the sauna or the steam room, like alternating. And it was my first ever ice bath. And holy dooly, I thought my feet were going to come off.
You did so well, though. You did like 4 minutes, didn't you, with the second round?
Three the second round. The first time I didn't do too well, but it's certainly like a case of mind over matter, isn't it, with these ice baths? Like you've just got to – and I also feel like the trick is to just not move, because if you don't move, you can kind of just like not feel your body because it's so cold. And I felt like if I could just breathe through that, then I could last a little bit longer. But I got egged on by that guy that was in the sauna that was like, oh, I think I'd do about 4 minutes. I was like, oh, I'm going to beat you because I'm a bit competitive like that.
Oh, no, it was a really, really nice morning. And yeah, I'm proud of you for doing your 3 minutes. Anyway, enough about us. You guys want to hear about today's guest, who is an absolutely incredible woman. Her name is Rosie Batty, and if you're based in Australia like us, then some of you are probably already familiar with Rosie and her story. In February 2014, Rosie's son, Luke, was tragically murdered by his dad, and he was only 14.
And what's unbelievable about Rosie's story is that the next day, in front of the media, who were all swarming her doorstep, Rosie bravely spoke about Luke's death and the tragic consequences of domestic and family violence. And just like that, in an instant, she became, as she calls it, an accidental hero. And in the 10 years since, she's become a fierce advocate and helped to take it from a personal issue to a national one, helping so many others along the way.
And what I find so admirable about Rosie is that although she was campaigning constantly, you know, she won Australian of the Year, she all of a sudden overnight had this public persona. Trying to keep it all together, though, she was actually still a grieving mum who was trying to find hope. And that is the title of her new book. And it's all about finding hope when the very worst thing happens. Guys, we hope that this conversation gives you some strength and hope too, and we've included helpful links to domestic violence support and resources in the show notes. Now, before we get into the convo, don't forget to hit subscribe. And if Good Morning has helped you and you have a spare minute, it would mean so much to us if you could leave us a rating or a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Rosie, congratulations on your new book, Hope, and welcome to the podcast. We are big admirers of yours. And although we've just awkwardly had a little interaction where I showed you your copy of the book and you said that you actually haven't even got a copy of the book yet because we're recording this a couple of months in advance of when it's published, we actually devoured it and often found ourselves nodding along furiously, especially the ways that you describe grief. So thank you for sharing your story so bravely for the second time and for joining us today in this conversation. It's a real treat.
It's a pleasure.
And Rosie, we're speaking to you the week after Luke's 10th anniversary. Mm. And we know that that must be a very difficult month for you. And towards the end of your book, actually, you mentioned that you were unsure how you were going to spend, you know, how you're going to mark the day. And so we're a bit curious, what did you end up doing?
I visited Luke's Memorial Garden. I always do. I go there regularly anyway, but I always make sure there are some yellow flowers. And I got there early and bumped into one of his classmates from when he started school in prep, who was doing the same thing, just quietly before he went to work, dropping off some flowers. And that was lovely to have a bit of a hug and share a few minutes with him. And then I, you know, really spent the time at home, not really wanting to do much of anything, but finding myself either responding to phone calls, responding to text messages, receiving flowers. But I'd always light a card. I always light a candle, and I got a particularly nice candle that I lit and sat quietly and didn't really seek a lot of company. But I had invited half a dozen of friends and colleagues that had been particularly supportive to me since Luke's death. And I wanted to cook dinner for them and take the time to really show my appreciation that they had really been amazing supports. So I actually spent the day doing all those things, but also preparing for a lovely dinner that I was cooking that night. And it was lovely. It was lovely.
I think sometimes we do need that solitude, but then we also need that connection, don't we, when we're faced with big milestone days. And we always talk to our audience and supporters and say, just mark the date in your calendar. And it can mean so much when people hear from others on difficult milestone days, can't it? So love to hear that you got some unexpected messages and flowers from people who you might not have assumed would remember. That it really can help carry you through a difficult day, can't it?
Look, I think so. I think we do in our, you know, I know I'm that person that sometimes does shut down, and I know that people will say, why didn't you ring me? Why didn't you ring me? And you think, well, actually, I don't ring because I actually don't want to speak to people right now. And I know that I can pick up the phone. I know that I have, you know, so many people that would do anything for me if I asked them to, whatever that would be. But sometimes it just sit with the sadness and want to sit in the sadness and not want to perk up or put on a show or be positive or just lift. Sometimes you just want to be quietly sad and allowing yourself to be sad because you know it will pass. And it passed yesterday. So I had quite a few days feeling very, you know, maybe you could say depressed. I just feel sad. And like I said, I know what I can do to lift my spirits. But sometimes I choose to give myself permission to say it's okay to be sad right now and not to feel like I have to distract myself or do something that will cheer me up. That actually I have every reason to feel sad that it's been 10 years since Luke was so cruelly taken from me, and I don't get to share the milestones that I see my friends sharing with their children and their young grown-ups and their families. And those are a lot of quiet reflections at times that you don't share because you don't want to be a burden on people, or you don't want people to really know what you're truly thinking and feeling because you don't want them to feel uncomfortable or guilty for what they have. So there are all these things that you juggle at different times, and you don't always want to people to know. But so I think I had the right a good balance of allowing people in that I knew. Sometimes I've been so grateful for the generosity and kindness so many people have shown me, and I haven't always felt that I've been able to show people enough or thank people enough, that there is so much gratitude from me that they, through the worst of my pain, through the most difficult of times, and when I've been at my most vulnerable, which hasn't always looked good, it has been difficult to be around me at times. I want people to know just how much I've appreciated them sticking around, being there for me, still being a friend, still loving me, still wanting to, still even admiring me, when there've been times when I have hated myself. So that support, that compassion, that acceptance, that emotional intelligence really has helped me return to being the person I more enjoy being, that I like being, and that is more of me.
I
So,
think we've got
I
a.
don't, people do play such a big part in all of this.
Yeah, I think we've got a lot to learn from you, Rosie. And I love that you mentioned as well that, there is that aftermath of those milestones as well, which I think people who haven't experienced loss may not necessarily think that it's not just the day that they died where we do feel these things. It's often the anticipation leading up to the day and then the aftermath of it as well. Like yesterday was my mum's 4th anniversary, and I'm definitely in that aftermath. I ate way too much comfort food. I'm feeling a bit hungover from that. But yeah, it takes a while to, I guess, and it is important for us to sit in that sadness too, and or acknowledge whatever we're feeling, at that time.
Yeah, and I think that that's, it's not easy for people to know what they can do. And sometimes there is nothing that they can do but just be there when you want them to be there, or not judge you or question you or try and perk you up or whatever. It's and also the anniversary of his death, I think it affects me more than I realize. I knew this one was going to be a big one, and I think next year will be too, because I'm very mindful, and I always have been, that at some point I will have lost him for longer than I ever had him. And that is next year, I will have lost him for 11 years. And I find that very difficult to understand. Sometimes you don't realize when you're going to have a bit of feel something more than you on typical days, because people expect you to feel really sad at Christmas or at Mother's Day or his birthday. But sometimes, as you said, it's something that's just triggered you and think, I will never be that grandmother. I will never be that person. I will have to reconcile for the rest of my life. I will not have the same moments of celebration that my friends will go experience. And likewise, the same moments of pain and sadness and frustration that they will have through their children and family members, because, you know, it's not all happiness that we bring each other. You know, there's a lot of stress and worry that young people will always bring to their parents, as you hope they survive driving like lunatics or binge drinking, all the things I didn't, mind you, when I was younger. And I have no doubt that Luke would be pushing boundaries and making me worry for the rest of, you know, for as long as I can think, because you just, you know, it's so you realize that these are the things you're going to always sit with. But I had a special moment this morning. My brother sent me a screenshot of his daughter's phone, and his daughter now is, I think she's 12, coming up to being 12. So she's already going to be older than Luke. And she was about 18 months old when I visited with Luke. And there's a picture of her in her little pushchair, and there's a picture of Luke with her. And she's got that picture on her mobile phone, which was really quite surprising and very touching, because she would have no memory of him. But that was a special photo for her because of how my brother and his wife have shared Luke with his children. So it saddens me, touches me, and makes me happy all in the same moment, really, you know. So it's nice.
And I think it can be a really powerful gift, can't it, that others can give to you when they show you that they are remembering the person that you're remembering, that they live on.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the sad things, is when people don't feel that they can mention him or talk about him, because even if you, you know, even if you get teary, and then people think, oh God, I shouldn't have said anything, it's actually quite the opposite. And it's lovely to be able to talk about him, even if it brings up tears. You know, you feel saddened that more people don't talk about him, and they may have conversations with each other, but that they don't involve me. So I don't know what happens in my friend's family home, unless they tell me, oh, we thought about Luke today and we were just remembering when he did whatever. And I think, oh, that's so nice. But unless people tell you, you just have no idea that he still figures in people's lives. Those little friends he had that were only, you know, that he's still a big part of their lives, and he'll never be forgotten. And you need to know that. You do need to know that.
100%. So anyone who is listening, who's supporting somebody who's grieving, take note, share memories, say their name. I think people, like you said, Rosie, people feel awkward, but actually it's normally the one name that we really want to hear. So if anyone's listening to this, definitely try sharing a memory. And Rosie, so your wonderful book, Hope, it starts from your journey after Luke died. I wanted to go back to the day after Luke died, when you had swarms of press outside your house, and your speech about family domestic violence was heard across the nation and the world. And you stood there as a grieving mother and you shared some incredibly powerful words. Did you have any idea at the time the impact that you were going to have, or were you just literally on autopilot and it just... out? Like, was there a plan or
no plan? I mean, ultimately, when something so catastrophic happens to you like that, you really are in shock. the enormity and reality and the finality are just more than you can absorb or comprehend. So you're kind of aware but not aware. I mean, it's a really strange sensation to find yourself in and out of, kind of being present. And I think the day I did that, I was really out of stubbornness, to be frank. It wasn't even with any agenda or any plan. But I don't like people making decisions on my behalf. And I think that's what we can tend to do for people when we think we can help them by protecting them. So we'll make those decisions for them because we're helping. But for me, I wanted to make my own decisions, even in that early stage. And so if anyone was going to talk to the media to ask them to leave, somehow I felt that that was my responsibility and to me to do that, if that's what I wanted. And that was really why I went out there without any idea of what I was going to say, other than I think I felt I was going to say something along the lines of, thank you for coming, doing your job, but out of respect, could you please leave me in peace and privacy? I'm sure, something from the movies had resonated with me, and I felt that that was an appropriate and respectful way. And it was, even one of the journalists wrote an article in the newspaper the other weekend saying that, in the 45 years of journalism as a hardened journalist, that was the most impactful moment of his career, where I chose to speak with their encouragement and sensitivity. And I had studied family violence in my diploma of community welfare. So I had understood the myths around family violence, and I did have a theoretical understanding of it. But how that came out, how I thought in that moment of what to say, I really don't know. It was just spontaneous. And I've always, I fail my own expectations very often. But I always try to be the better person. And as I said, in the moment, I'm not always that. But I didn't want people to... I saw no space for blame and anger and bitterness. I just thought, this is, something good has got to come from this. And I didn't want my friends or anyone to talk angrily about Luke's father, Greg. I just didn't want that negativity. I just wanted us to come together.
Something that you said when you did come out and address the nation, you said, this can happen to anybody. It can happen to somebody who's living in the perfect house. It can happen to intelligent people. And I think that shocked everyone, because it was the first time that that's been talked about. And I think it's always domestic and family violence has always been something that's happened behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of misconceptions about it. So, and then since then, you've gone on to do some incredible advocacy and campaigning work around domestic and family violence. Can you talk to us about some of the other myths and misconceptions about it?
Yeah, look, and we have come a long way since that time I did speak. And I'm very, very aware that the reason I was heard is because I did defy those myths. Mm. I was a white, middle-class, privileged woman, not the expected type, so to speak, that experiences family violence. So some of those other myths are around, what causes violence. We like to blame people that may blame it on mental illness or alcohol consumption or drug addiction. But the reality is, violence is a choice, and it is always about power and control. Yeah. And so even though those other factors can contribute and greatly, you know, increase the severity of violence. They are not the cause of it. And so I think that's another big big shift for us to try and look to blame people for actions we cannot comprehend. And so we think they must have been insane to do that. A person in their right mind. But the fact that this was a premeditated act, and many of the ones that I'm aware of that have resulted in some horrific outcomes, they're premeditated. There is, you know, and that's the same with Luke. We also hadn't realised, you know, the different forms of violence. And, you know, and we kind of, again, used to, if it wasn't that people were physically abused and showing some kind of injury, well, it wasn't that bad, or it wasn't really violence. And so I think now we recognise that what financial abuse can look like, that can look like withholding child support payments and deliberately placing your ex-partner and your children in hardship and poverty. We also understand a lot more about psychological abuse and that those put downs and deliberate erosion of self-esteem and overly controlling, where you're controlling somebody by what friends they can have, how often they can see their family, whether they can work, what kind of work, what clothes, what friends. That's all very controlling behaviours. And we've now arrived at the term coercive control, where we're beginning to comprehend and understand what does that mean. That means all of these kind of opportunities to have a control over you, to undermine you, to gaslight you so that you think you are going mad and all the problems and all the faults are your fault, are deliberate tactics over periods of time that are uniquely the dynamic between you and that ex-partner.
I unfortunately learned about coercive control the hard way. I lost my mum to suicide in February of 2020, and after she died, we found out a devastating revelation that the woman that she'd married wasn't who she said she was, and my mum was a victim of coercive control in a 18-year relationship, and the person was not at all who they said they were. And we lived with, you know, she was my stepmother, they were married, they by all accounts had an incredible relationship, and none of us saw any of the red flags because we were so, you know, caught up in it. And she'd created the perfect lie that she'd never be questioned. So my mum was an intelligent woman, and it happens to, like you said, anybody. And so I've learned the hard way that domestic and family violence isn't what you see on the posters. It's not a black eye all the time, and sometimes a lot more subtle and difficult to spot. And often the emotional abuse and the psychological abuse that you talked about has very devastating consequences as well. So thank you for talking about that.
Sal, let's take a moment to talk about this season's sponsor, Picaluna Beautiful Funerals. So like us, most of you listening have probably either planned or attended your loved one's funeral. Sal, did you have any idea about what your mum wanted her funeral to be like?
I literally had a tiny idea that she wanted bright colours, and that was it. What about you, Em?
Well, we never actually got to have the conversation about how she wanted her funeral, but I do remember her telling me once, this is quite funny, that she wanted to attend her own funeral so that she could hear all of the nice things that everyone had to say about her.
Oh, I love that. That's quite a good idea.
Classic Vanessa. How good, should we just have our funeral and like say all the nice things? But this is one of the main reasons, I don't think I've told you this either, but why I got up and did her eulogy, even though it was so difficult to do, because I knew from that conversation, if she was going to be anywhere that day, she would have been right there listening to what nice things that we had to say about her. But other than that, you know, I think I was just so out of it. I couldn't help with the planning at all. My sister had to pick up all of the pieces and take care of all of the planning. She is an instrumental griever. And I couldn't do it. But I do wish that I had chatted with my mum about the finer details. But how the hell do you even start those conversations?
Well, I think it's as simple as starting with like asking a question like, what piece of music is significant to you? Or what hobbies or passion do you feel reflect your personality best?
Yeah, I love those suggestions. Like they're good. And I think the thing is, being prepared for a death in your circle can sometimes feel like a daunting task, but it's something that touches us all. So I think these conversations regarding death can be difficult, but they're important to have.
They really are, and it is all about the personal touches. And that's why what Piccoluna is doing is so important, because not only do they provide end-of-life consultancy and doula support, they also help you facilitate these difficult conversations, and they make them so much easier. You know, they do the whole shebang. Their funeral arranger meets you and helps guide you in creating meaningful funerals and within your budget as well, which I think is really important. And they help you personalize it your way, so that you can really honor your person in a way that reflects them. And that could be something like, you know, a paddle out with surfers to scatter the ashes, or a gathering in bushland, by the ocean, in an event centre. Whatever you want to do, they can help you make it happen.
I wish I had known there were so many choices available. I 100% would have had Mum's funeral out in the Red Desert. She loved the outback. But something else that I love that Piccoluna are doing is they give back and they donate 5% of their profit to one of their Piccoluna charity partners, which I think is really beautiful.
Yeah, that is so beautiful. And I really love that they're giving back in that way. So guys, whether you're caring for someone at end of life, or like us, you know how bloody hard planning a funeral is when you're deep in grief, start having the conversation today with Piccoluna Beautiful Funerals. Now, back to the show.
How have you managed the emotional toll? All of a sudden, you know, a year later, you're Australian of the Year, and you're on this kind of path of trailblazing, and I think somebody called you a policy entrepreneur, is that right?
And yeah,
which is, yeah, I quite like that term.
Yeah, I think that was Lisa Wheldon, or that was some part of a research that she was doing. Yes, you're right.
And but while you're making change and you're out there advocating, you're also a grieving mum. How did you manage that self-care and your needs from an emotional and physical level while also continuing to advocate and make change? Because they're quite different spheres to be in, aren't they?
And
to
oscillate. They were between. And I don't think I did. I think the when people saw me in public, I clearly had it together, but behind the scenes at home, you know, I'd go to bed every night feeling very alone, very alone. You know, where were those people that I thought were my friends? And it's not that they weren't there, it's just they weren't there because they didn't know I was at home crying alone. They thought I was jet-setting somewhere as Australian of the Year. And so this amazing opportunity that was given to me also made me feel incredibly isolated. And don't get me wrong, I travelled nearly. I spoke at 250 events that year, 180 the following year. Then I stopped counting. So I was immersed, and that was my survival. It was my distraction, but I wouldn't acknowledge it as a distraction at the time. I felt that it gave me purpose and meaning, and I really don't know what I would have done without immersing myself. And I can see why people do that. It gives you something to get up and do. That is something that you're giving, you know, that, you know, most people, so many people who've gone through something, I hear them say, I'm speaking out because I don't want someone else to have to go through what I'm going through. So you're compelled to want to somehow make sure that what you're experiencing can help somebody else. So I think for me, I was difficult at times, because I didn't have any balance. I was completely immersed in this. I was exhausted. I was drinking every day to numb my pain. I had taken up smoking when I hadn't smoked for a very, very long time. And I wasn't, you know, so I was doing all the self-soothing strategies that are not long-term helpful. I think everybody can potentially find themselves numbing their pain in ways that are accessible. And often that is through alcohol, even prescribed medications. You're just numbing the pain to get through. But in time, you know, I put on a lot of weight. I was very unfit, very unhealthy, and I realized was very unhappy as well. But I was in a position where I could take opportunities that I wouldn't have been able to do if Luke was still alive. So I did a 4-week volunteering stint in Borneo, looking, you know, cleaning out orangutan cages and other species that you know was hard. God, that was hard. It was hard work in a very hot and humid climate. You know, I went on a horse trek in the Victorian High Country because that was always on my bucket list, the Mount from Snowy River Country. It was just really hard and really enjoyable in a very challenging way, in the most stunning of scenery. It's fantastic. I did, you know, I've been on several walks around the world, and I'm committed to doing as many of those as I can for the rest of my life, because that is truly where I know I find peace and simplicity. And I just know how it on every level, it's really good for me to trek. And so I've been able to be able to do that and made new friends doing that as well, and gone with some, you know, people who are in their, you know, elderly people, and they, believe me, they've really shown me the way of what's possible when you're in your 70s, the quality of life you can still have, providing you keep moving, keep being open to adventure, being open to life, and having fun, and having the cheeky Prosecco, and to hell with it. It's given me the inspiration to know that that is what I want to do. I want to enjoy the rest of my life by being as healthy as I can be. And I've always been relatively healthy. I've got good genes, I will say. Thanks, Dad. but I've also been mindful about diet. I eat too much chocolate, and I eat too much because I do like food, but I do know healthy eating is. And so now I, you know, I've over time recognized that I feel much better in myself, nurturing myself and making sure that I've got a balance. And that balance also means I don't want to be talking about family violence all of the time. That is part of will always be important to me, that how can I continue to influence change, have a meaningful contribution and earn an income, doing something I believe in. But it can't all be about family violence. And so I find, you know, gender equality inspiring. And so, you know, there is a lot of inspiration around, you know, the intelligence of women, the being around inspiring women who are smart, you know, whether they're politicians, and there's lots of them, you know, there's some really inspiring, brilliant people doing some great things. And I feel so privileged that I'm respected as an equal in that space. Because one of the things I really struggled with is I'm one of those, as you said, the club that no one wants to join. I'm one of those that people will go, that's that woman. You know, the one that lost her son. That one. The one that people will see, feel sorry for. I'm the one that, you know, like people notice and talk about. And that was hard because when people put you up on a platform, it's impossible to live up to that image. You know, I swear a bit. I can be grumpy and short with people, including the people I love the most.
It's often them that cop the brunt, isn't it?
And I don't, you know, I've got to really be mindful that I'm a strong, forthright person and how that can come across, even if I don't intend it to. So I'm mindful of the more balanced I am, the more aware I am, the better I am with whoever it is that I cross paths with, whether it's in, you know, and so, I enjoy being that person. I don't enjoy being the person that reacts defensively and aggressively or is angry at somebody that really is undeserving of the degree of anger that I direct at them. And I know a lot of that is trauma and PTSD. And I didn't know whether I was juggling, what the hell I was juggling. I just know I didn't like my behavior or how I felt and how I reacted. I didn't know where you could, you know, which one was that? What was that, the grief or was that? And I actually don't even know whether I went through menopause. I really do not. Yeah, on top of everything else, I could very well have been going through menopause too. But I had so much going on. And people who, including immediate family members, didn't understand my pain and my reactions and some would take that personally. And some people withdrew out of my life. And that really upset me, that my apologies didn't work, that I couldn't understand how at the worst points in my life people backed out of my life. I couldn't understand how people could do that. I still struggle with that, actually. But what you've got to look at is they have their own reasons, and sometimes they have to place their own boundaries for their own reasons, and they have the right to do that, no matter how you feel about it. But new people come in, and those new people bring other things into your life. And in time, and now I can look back and go, you know what? I've really got nothing in common with that person anymore anyway. And they would have never have gone the distance in my life. Because people come in and out of it. You can't hold on to everybody. And I guess that's the thing that, you know, very sensitive to. And if I speak to a lot of people who've gone through something that is, you know, catastrophic or deeply saddening, the loss of a partner, the loss of a parent, you know, everyone will say the same. Some people you expect to always be there aren't. And the new you, the new life you create, does open up for new people to come into it that are more relevant, perhaps, more connection for a journey, for a period of time, and to embrace that and be thankful, I guess. And that's what where I'm at now, I think. But, you know, there were times where I did want to give up. I did want to give up. And it was around that 3-year mark. I came back from Borneo and I was at the start of the year again, this time last, you know, when approaching Luke's anniversary, and when I do not want another year of pain. I can't see this will ever change. And I just felt so hopeless. And I was in Sydney speaking somewhere, and I was going from one place to the next, and I was in the back of a cab. And in Sydney, your roads are a lot narrower and, you know, busy and stuff. And I pushed the door of the taxi to jump out, and a bus came past and took the door off its hinges. Wow. And I remember sitting there thinking, am I disappointed that I'm alive? Or relieved that I didn't get killed? And it was a very poignant time, because I didn't feel like I wanted to end my life, but I did want something to take it away. And, you know, those are the kind of... And when people perhaps think the first few weeks and months are the hardest, and you get through the first year and then there's the second year, for me it was the third year, because I felt so alone. I felt so disconnected. I'm no longer a mum. I'm not fitting in with the mums groups. My neighbours don't know me other than a polite wave. You know, where are my genuine relationships? Now, some of them are still there regardless. But I read a book called Lost Connections, and that really, really helped me understand my connection into this local community was because of Luke, with Luke, through Luke.
Is that Johan Hari's book?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I've got that on my bookshelf, actually. Right here.
Have you?
I can see it. It's on my reading list.
I've got his next one, actually. I've got another one of his, which is something about attention.
It's attention. Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's good reviews. But you'd recommend reading this one then, Lost Connections.
I think it's brilliant. Oh. I think it really... It helped me understand that I'd lost Luke, and that was my connection. And why I felt so abandoned and disconnected was because I wasn't a mum in the mums group. Mm-hmm. So I'm not included or invited because it's not, you know, I'm not part of the group anymore. And it's not a deliberately nasty thing that they're doing. It's just... by virtue of their activities and their busy days and their school drop-offs or whatever they're doing, you're all gravitating because you're all in the same space. And so, you know, whether it's – so for me to understand that my connection now to this community mostly is my dogs, because wherever I go, it'll be walking my dogs. And you have doggy conversations and recognize a lot of the same people, and you have a bit of conversation and a bit of a chat. And sometimes you have some of people's dogs are not good and not nice. And so we, you know, and things. So that's my connection into community. And I'm okay with that now. I'm okay with that. But it was a really difficult time. I can still feel isolated and alone, and I do think perhaps that stems back from when I lost my mum when I was six, and there are some things from that trauma that have really that I haven't understood, and no one did back then, and no one did. We talk about trauma a lot more now. We have a better understanding of it, but that's only over the like maybe 15 years, maybe 20 tops.
Thank you for sharing that with us, because I think a lot of people who haven't experienced a big loss think that the first year is the hardest.
Yeah.
And like you said, for you, the third year was the hardest. And I think it's really important to raise awareness of that, because often we're just trying to survive the first couple of years, right? And in your case, survive and then also navigate life as a public figure. And it's the markers of time as time goes on and the isolation that we feel.
Yeah.
That actually can be the hardest. So I think it's really important to know. And I know that you do talk about that in your book. But Rosie, final question from us. You just talked about the third year being the hardest and how you were really isolated. So how have you found hope? What has hope looked like for you as the 10 years have gone by?
I guess part of me is having gratitude. That helps me shift negativity, seeing so much to be grateful for and so much that you really appreciate, and really being mindful about that, because that is something, you know, you really need to be conscious of, I think, because it's just too easy to not see the things that are actually making you feel good or nice or happy, or, you know, and really appreciate those. But I think, so hope for me isn't always a permanent state of being, and I don't think that is realistic. And what I can, so there are, you know, a number of things that help me return to having an optimistic view of life, or a certainty of change, or a expectation of something better. And is that hope? Yeah, I guess it is. So for me, I know that some people, because of their views, their bias, their prejudice, their lack of compassion, those people in my life can really not contribute positively to me when I'm feeling not great. So I do know that as soon as I'm feeling perhaps less hopeful or more negative or losing enthusiasm, being surrounded and reaching out to and connecting with like-minded people helps you get back to and keep that. I can't change the world, I've realized that, but what I can do while I'm here is contribute in the best way I can with my unique skills, my unique strengths, my unique journey that have been given. And if that inspires some people and takes them out of and helps them through a very difficult time and gives them hope, that's amazing. Because in my book, there are some stories of other people, predominantly women, who have gone through horrendous journeys, and they inspired me. And I want people to know that there's a lot of people, loads of people, that have unimaginable things happen to them. And you may see on the news, just like today, there'll be some, you know, there is some fairly horrendous things happening. And you go, how does that family ever survive? How do those children ever recover? How do they ever get on with their lives? But you never know, because you never hardly ever hear from about them again. So you don't know what their journey is. You don't know how well or how badly or how difficult, you don't know. So we imagine that if something terrible happens to us, we would never be able to deal with it. And we think we could never deal with that. But we do.
And I think you are a living proof of that, Rosie, and you're an inspiration to so many, and especially including to Sal and I. And we are so grateful for this time and for you sharing your experience since losing Luke. And yeah, we just want to say thank you. It's been a real honor.
Thank you, Imogen. Thank you, Sal.